This episode of TGC's Word of the Week is sponsored by the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Theological training is essential for faithful ministry. Visit the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and see how we prepare ministers of the gospel. Learn more at sbts.edu/visit.
God is everywhere at all times at work, but very often we don't see him. Very often his hand is hidden. And maybe we see it, but only after the fact, or maybe only in heaven. And the author of Esther is giving us a picture of what life actually feels like, the way we actually experience life.
This is TGC's Word of the Week, a sermon podcast from the Gospel Coalition. This week's sermon, How to Read Esther, was preached by Stephen Whitmer at Pepperell Christian Fellowship in Pepperell, Massachusetts, on February 4, 2018. The text is Esther chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 2, verse 18. Listen now to Stephen Whitmer on How to Read Esther.
This morning we are beginning a 7-part series on Esther, book of the Bible, that has provoked radically differing responses over the thousands of years since it was written. Famous Jewish medieval scholar Maimonides said that Esther was second only to the Torah in importance. Even today, Esther is read, known, treasured around the world by Jewish families, as it has been for hundreds of years, thousands of years now, as they celebrate the Jewish feast of Purim. On the other end of the spectrum of response is Martin Luther, who is very critical of the book of Esther. He said he could wish it didn't exist at all. And for the record, I think Luther was wonderfully right in his teaching on justification by faith and dead wrong in his view of Esther. As we study this book, we're going to see some of the surprising features of it that have led to those very differing responses to it. And I have been praying, that we will see a beauty and a truthfulness in this book that will show us more of the beauty and truthfulness of God and God's plan that comes to climax in the person and work of Jesus Christ, and that this will give us strong encouragement and hope. This morning we're going to be in Esther chapter 1, verse 1, all the way through Esther chapter 2, verse 18. And I want us to meet four of the five main characters of this remarkable book. So let's get right to it. We're going to begin with King Ahasuerus, and we'll meet him by reading chapter 1, verses 1 through 22, all of the first chapter of Esther. So take out your Bible, follow along, and let's read starting in verse 1. Now in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the capital, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. When those days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars, and also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king, and drinking was according to this edict, there is no compulsion. For the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, and Abagtha, Zether, and Karkas, 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. At this, the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in law and judgment, the men next to him being Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marsena, and Memucan, seven princes of Persia and Media, who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. According to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti? Because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs. Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also against all the officials and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath and plenty. If it please the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes so that it may not be repealed, that Vashti is never again to come before King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. This advice pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, that every man be master in his own household and speak according to the language of his people. From the very first Hebrew word of this book, the author indicates that he intends us to read this work as recording events that actually happened, not as fiction, but as reality, because the opening word now, it's translated now by the ESV, in Hebrew is a formula that's used to begin other historical books in the Old Testament, including Joshua and Judges. In verse 1, we're told the events of the story take place in the reign of King Ahasuerus, the king of Persia. He's better known to history by his Greek name, Xerxes. So again, verse 1 roots the book of Esther in history, both in secular history and in biblical history. Ahasuerus reigned from 486 to 465 BC. So just to put that in context for us, to locate it in terms of other events we might be more familiar with, Cyrus of Persia had allowed some Jews to return from exile to Jerusalem in 539 BC. That's about 55 years before Ahasuerus begins to reign. And the Jewish exiles had completed the temple around 515 BC. That's about 30 years before Ahasuerus begins to reign. A generation after his reign, in about 445 BC, Nehemiah traveled to Jerusalem to help with the rebuilding of the wall. So the story of Esther is set right in the midst of these events, before and after, that have to do with Jewish exiles being in strange lands, foreign lands, and beginning to return. We have evidence about Xerxes from other ancient literature outside the Bible, including the histories of Herodotus. And one scholar notes that Xerxes comes across in the works of Herodotus as ambitious, as a bold warrior with vision and confidence once he's overcome his superstitious fears. And there is plenty of evidence, the scholar says, for his exploits with women, as we're going to see when we get to chapter 2. Esther 1 paints a picture of Ahasuerus as an impotent potentate. There's a contrast between appearance and reality. He is simultaneously powerful and puny. He looks wonderful, and he's actually weak. Look again at verses 1 through 9. These verses are intended to impress us with the greatness of this king and his kingdom. Starts with the 180-day display of the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness. If I was going to display my greatness, I'd run out after about 2 days. It takes him 180 days to display all his pomp and power. And after that display, he throws a seven-day feast for everyone in the capital city of Susa. Maybe he's saying thank you to the residents of Susa for hosting all these other folks from away in the 180 days. In any case, look at the description of this seven-day feast that everyone gets to come to. Verse 6 describes the lavish decor. I mean, the driveway is made of gems and precious stones. Verse 7 describes the serving vessels. They're golden. There's all different kinds of them. Verses 7 and 8 record the open bar policy. As much as you want to drink. And the point is, this king is swimming in power and wealth, and he lavishes it upon whomever he chooses. The city of Susa was excavated in the late 19th century, and lo and behold, many treasures were discovered. Glazed bricks, jewelry, sculptures. So we're meant to be at least a little bit in awe after we read verses 1 through 9. And that's what makes the turn of events in verses 10 and following so surprising. Frankly, quite humorous. Because we see Ahasuerus is maybe not quite as powerful as we originally thought he was. After this 180-day display of his splendor and pomp, we realize he can't even control his own wife, Queen Vashti. Verse 10, he's drunk. He wants to show his friends what a beautiful wife he has, so he commands that Vashti be brought in and put on display. And here's the shocker in verse 12. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. Now that obviously is a huge insult. It's a huge embarrassment to the king in front of all these folks he's trying to impress. And so he becomes very angry. And we see now how very weak he really is. He doesn't know what to do. So he seeks the counsel of seven princes. If I called in seven princes to help Emma and me work through our marital disagreements, that would not be a sign of health in our relationship. One of those seven princes, Memucan, proposes a plan that we might summarize roughly as depose and replace. Get Vashti out of there as soon as possible and find a replacement for her. And the stated rationale for acting with urgency and with severity is that if the king doesn't respond that way, all the other women in the realm, in all these other provinces, will look on their husbands with contempt. Because they'll see that's what Vashti did, and she got away with it. Whereas when they hear about the consequences of her disrespect and disobedience, they will, according to verse 20, give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. In other words, these men who are the chief counselors of this king seem to greatly fear the women of the realm. This is a very low view of marriage, of husband and wife. It implies a relationship that's founded on coercion, therefore on weakness rather than on mutual love. And we're going to see later in this book that there is a much better model provided of men and women relating to one another through Mordecai and his adopted daughter Esther. In this case, the king hides behind official policy and the proclamation of laws. He doesn't apparently go to his wife and reason with her. He huddles with his counselors and creates a law. And ironically, his decree that Vashti can no longer come into his presence is the very thing Vashti wasn't willing to do in the first place. Maybe this king is actually weaker than we might realize. In fact, the first readers of Esther would have known something that we probably don't know, namely that 4 years after this, Xerxes would suffer a surprising defeat in Greece that drained away much of his spectacular wealth. Things are not always what they seem. And that's going to be part of the message of Esther. As we walk through it, we should be reminded, and we will be regularly reminded, that no one, not even those who seem the mightiest, not even those who seem to have the greatest control, the most lasting power, no one compares to God. God rules, reigns over all. No one even comes close to rivaling his sovereign authority. And we'll see that throughout Esther. In chapter 2, we meet two more main characters. So I want to keep going. We're going to meet Esther and Mordecai. And I'll read the first 18 verses of Esther 2. We'll leave it there for today. We'll come back and start in verse 19 next week. So for now, Esther chapter 2. And let's see Esther and Mordecai in verses 1 through 18. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's young men who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the capital, under custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given them. And let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This pleased the king, and he did so. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is, Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in custody of Hegai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Hegai, who had charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor. And he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and her portion of food and with seven chosen young women from the king's palace and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. Now when the turn came for each young woman to go into King Ahasuerus after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for women, when the young woman went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem in custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter, to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Hegai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women. And she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. We meet Mordecai in verse 5. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai. And we're immediately told two important pieces of information about him, his ancestry, and how he came to be in Susa. So first, his ancestry, see the little phrase there, that he is the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite. The phrase son of probably means descendant of. So this is not his grandfather and great-grandfather necessarily, but it's his line of his lineage. He's from the tribe of Benjamin, which is the tribe that King Saul came from. And you notice he has a Kish in his ancestry. King Saul was the son of a man named Kish. And we're meant to recognize that because when we get to chapter 3 of Esther and we meet Haman the Agagite, we'll hear the name Agag. Agag was the king of the Amalekites whom God had commanded King Saul to kill. You can read this elsewhere in the Bible. And Saul did not kill Agag. And it was because of Saul's disobedience that God took away Saul's dynasty and judged Saul. And we'll see in the conflict in this book of Esther, the conflict between Mordecai and Haman, a continued playing out of the long-running conflict between Israel and the Amalekites. It's a conflict that started all the way back in the Exodus period when Amalek wronged Israel. And in the book of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy 25, God commanded Israel to remember and never forget to destroy the Amalekites. So Esther is part of a larger biblical story we will see unfold. Second thing we learn about Mordecai is how he came to be living in Susa. And we see that in verse 6. Mordecai had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. Now, Mordecai himself wouldn't have been alive when Jeconiah was exiled. If he had been, he would be over 100 years old in this story of Esther. So I think probably the author is describing Mordecai in solidarity with his ancestors who had been taken into exile. In some sense, the author is saying, even though he hadn't been born yet at that point, when his ancestors came, he himself was coming to Susa. So here he is. He's living far from home. He's living in exile in the midst of a pagan people who do not worship the one true God. We're going to see as we walk through this book the tensions that come about for the people of God, the tensions that must be wrestled with when we seek to live faithfully in the midst of an ungodly culture. And I think this is very helpful for us to see as we live in what is largely a post-Christian culture. Rather than spending most of our time wishing that we were living in a Christian culture or imagining that America used to be a pervasively Christian culture, I think often we think it was more Christian than it was in fact, we should recognize, you know what? There have been many periods in the history of God's people where they've lived in a pagan culture. And often they flourished. They've been faithful to God. We think of Joseph in Egypt or Daniel in Babylon or the early Christians in the Roman Empire. And we see in this book of Esther what it means to seek to live faithfully. It's hard. It's difficult. There are tensions and challenges. We can see them in Esther 1 and 2 already. How do we live faithfully? Well, Esther will help us. In verse 7, we're introduced to the third major character of the book, Esther. Verse 7, Mordecai was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. And we're told a couple important things about Esther straight away. First, her relationship to Mordecai. She is Mordecai's cousin, the daughter of his uncle, but also she's his daughter. He's adopted her. He's raising her as his own daughter because her parents have died. We're not told how. And then secondly, we're told about Esther's appearance. She's beautiful. And that will be absolutely critical to the story that is to follow. Counselors of King Ahasuerus have persuaded him that he needs to find a replacement for Queen Vashti. And the way he will find a replacement is to have a procession of young virgins come into his bedroom, and he'll sleep with them one by one until he finds the one he wants to make the queen. The search for the young virgins, as counselors suggest, should extend throughout the whole Persian Empire. They're to be given cosmetics, and we learn in these verses we just read that they'll have a year's worth of cosmetic treatment. They'll get 6 months with oil of myrrh, 6 months with spices and ointments. Then they'll get to each spend one night with the king. The only way they'll ever see the king again, instead of just living a life of isolation in the royal harem after that, is if he pleases, they please him. In the words of this text, if the king delights in her. In other words, this is all for the king's sexual pleasure. And let's be clear, this is sexual exploitation of epic proportions. It's terrible. But it wasn't uncommon in the ancient world. In fact, it wasn't totally uncommon in Israel. We know that King Solomon of Israel had a huge number of wives and concubines. It's clearly not in keeping with the biblical sexual ethic, which says that sexual love is to be expressed between a man and a woman within the bonds of covenant marriage. We learn in verse 8 that in the midst of this kingdom-wide gathering of young virgins, Esther was taken into the king's palace and put in the custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. So the picture here is in Esther 2. Esther is inside the harem. She's receiving food and cosmetic treatment. Mordecai, her uncle, her father, is outside the harem. He's coming there every day in order to learn how she's doing. He's eager for news of how things are going. And it's right here that we run up against something that's pretty common in the Old Testament narratives, and particularly here in Esther. The narrator of this story doesn't tell us some of the things we most want him to say. We want him to weigh in on some of what he's just told us. We want him to say clearly and unequivocally what Ahasuerus is doing is ethically wrong. And he doesn't tell us that. He doesn't say. Often in the Old Testament narratives, the authors just describe the situation and then expect their readers to be morally formed enough, perhaps by reading the Torah, to be able to evaluate the good and the bad in what we've just been told. There's another thing we'd really like to know. How are Mordecai and Esther feeling about this turn of events? Esther being taken into the harem? And again, is the answer is we're simply not told. We want to know, Esther, how do you feel about being forced to sleep with a man who's not your husband? You're a Jew. You're forced to sleep with a pagan Gentile king. How do you feel about that? How are you doing with eating this food? Remember Daniel, when he was in Babylon, he didn't eat the food. We're not told that Esther didn't eat the food. So is she compromising? Is she disobeying? If she needs to disobey, how's she feel about it? Is she excited about currying favor with the king, about advancing in his favor? Or is she just doing what she needs to do to survive? We would love to know answers to these questions, and we're not told. We don't know. In fact, what we are told in verses 17 to 18 is King Ahasuerus' response to Esther after she spends the night with him. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast for all his officials and servants. It was Esther's feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. There's a bookend here between the beginning of Esther chapter 1 and the end of Esther chapter 2, because Esther 1 began with a queen who was absent at a feast, and Esther chapter 2 ends with a feast given for the new queen. And we're going to see throughout the book of Esther that feasts are very important. Some of the most important events in the book occur in and around feasts, and fasts are also pivotal, very important. So we've met so far King Ahasuerus, Mordecai, and Esther. I said at the beginning I wanted us to meet four of the five main characters in Esther. So who's the fourth? He's been here throughout chapters 1 and 2. He's not been mentioned explicitly. And I wonder if you know who I'm talking about. I'm talking about God. God is the fourth character I want us to see. God is one of the main characters. He is the main character of the book of Esther. But one of the distinctive features of this book, you might say one of the peculiarities of this book, is that it does not mention God even once. There are only two books in the entire Old Testament that never mention the name of God, the book of Esther and Song of Solomon. But here's the point. If we have eyes to see, we will see God's hand everywhere in this story. It's just that he operates behind the scenes. The chapters that we just read will make sense, more sense, as we move further into the story, and we'll see that God used even that weak, ill-tempered response of King Ahasuerus in deposing Vashti in order to place Esther on the throne of the queen for just the right time in order to preserve her people. And there's another indication, there's some hints in chapter 2 of God's hand at work. Maybe you noticed as I read, there's this threefold repetition of the theme of Esther receiving favor. She's finding grace and favor in various people's eyes. Verse 9 of chapter 2, the young woman Esther pleased him, Haggai, and won his favor. or verse 15 of chapter 2. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. Or verse 17, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. The Old Testament says elsewhere that God granted Jacob favor in Egypt, or Joseph favor in Egypt. It says that God granted Israel favor when they were leaving in the Exodus, leaving from Egypt. Psalm 84:11 says that the Lord bestows favor. Same word. The Lord bestows favor and honor. It's pretty clear, if you read this narrative, that God is the one granting Esther favor. He's the one moving her into the position of queen. But the author doesn't make that explicit. And the question is, why? This is the big question of the book of Esther. Why, if God is pervasively, profoundly at work, why does the author not tell us that he is? I guess there are probably many answers to that question, but here's one. It's that most of us experience God more like this. God is everywhere at all times at work, but very often we don't see him. Very often his hand is hidden. And maybe we see it, but only after the fact, or maybe only in heaven. And the author of Esther is giving us a picture of what life actually feels like, the way we actually experience life. But that's not to say that God isn't at work. God is, in the view of this author, everywhere, profoundly at work. This is his providence. This is what's called his providence. God's providence is his ability to do all things. The Lord sits in the heavens. He does all that he pleases. And one of my favorite definitions of God's providence comes from the Heidelberg Catechism. It was written in 1563. The question is, what is the providence of God? And here's the answer from the Heidelberg Catechism. It is the almighty and everywhere present power of God, whereby, as it were, by his hand, he upholds and governs heaven, earth, and all creatures, so that herbs and grass, rain and drought, fruitful and barren years, meat and drink, health and sickness, riches and poverty, yea, all things come not by chance, but by his fatherly hand. Everything that happens occurs through the almighty and everywhere present power of God. Every single thing in our lives, but we usually don't see it. God's the one bringing up the grass, but to us, we don't see his hand reaching down and pulling up the grass on our lawn. It just grows. God's the one providing the food, but it feels like, it looks like to us, we just went to the grocery store. But that was God's providence, allowing us to eat. God is pervasively, profoundly at work, but very often we don't see it in our lives, and therefore in this book of Esther. Even when we're not told by the author that God is actively at work, he is at work behind the scenes. And the title of the series is God's Providence Fulfills His Promise. His promise to his people is that he will be faithful to us. He will preserve us. He will protect us. And in this case, in Esther's day, these people have sinned. That's why they're living in Susa in the first place. They're in exile, away from the land. They've disobeyed God. But God has said, I will be faithful to you. I will protect you. And we'll see in this book that God is faithful to all his promises, and he'll work all things for the good of his people. By the way, his providence doesn't mean that Mordecai and Esther can just relax on the royal sofa. God's going to protect his people so we can just chill out. No, they again and again need to make difficult decisions and wrestle with ethical dilemmas, and they need to take bold, courageous action so God's providence undergirds their action. It doesn't undermine or undercut it. This points us, ultimately, this idea of God's providence to the gospel of Jesus Christ, because God provides, ultimately, for his people by sending his Son to live and die among us, to die a substitutionary death in our place, and to bring an ultimate salvation that is better, far better, than the salvation that Esther will be used to provide. Let me close by asking this important question, and then we're going to transition to the Lord's Supper. Here's the question. Given all that we've just seen in these first couple chapters of the book, how ought we to read the book of Esther? How ought we to read this book? What's the most profitable reading strategy for us? And here's a negative answer to that question. We shouldn't look to this book mainly to find moral examples. Remember, the author doesn't tell us what Esther and Mordecai are wrestling with. He doesn't tell us if they've compromised personally, ethically, morally. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. How do they feel about it? He just doesn't tell us. That's because his main goal in writing this book is not to give us moral examples. So we shouldn't mainly read the book of Esther saying, hey, Esther did this, let's do the same thing. King Ahasuerus did that, let's not do that thing. That's not the purpose of the book. Here's the way we ought to read the book of Esther. We ought to read it seeing it as a story of God's salvation. This is a story about God. He's the main character who is never mentioned. We ought to read this story to see God's promises to his people and his fulfillment of those promises, even against all odds. And here's what's exciting. The New Testament tells us that we are the people of God, and therefore we inherit his promises. So the book of Esther is therefore part of our story. We are seeing the faithfulness of God to his people through his hidden hand. The book of Esther, therefore, tells us how God preserves and cares for his people, how he preserves and cares for us. And we ought to read Esther looking mainly for what it tells us about God and about Christ, what it tells us about God's character and his plan of redemption. I'm excited over the next month and a half to understand more of the character of God and to treasure and value more his salvation.
You've been listening to TGC's Word of the Week. Check back next week for another gospel-centered sermon. We also invite you to visit the resources section of our website, thegospelcoalition.org, to find thousands of sermons to help you understand and apply God's Word.